Hey dudes, two quick things before we get into the show. Go grab tickets to my Melbourne International Comedy Festival show, 5th of April to the 20th of April. You can get tickets at alexwhitecomedy.com or follow me on Instagram, whitebaitonline there, and grab some tickets. It's going to be a lot of fun. And secondly, subscribe to the Patreon. We love doing the Patreon. It's so much fun. We've got some crazy ideas cooking up. You're going to absolutely love it. So get on board, grab the Patreon subscription online and through Spotify or through Patreon, $5 a month, and you get two bonus episodes, and they're an absolute blast. Thanks, team. Enjoy the episode. Trying to make a living, working hard to get to
heaven where I come from. Oh, yeah. Hello and welcome along to the Community Notice Board.
Hello, welcome to another episode of Community Notice Board, a podcast about suburbs we grew up in, local landmarks, hometown heroes, and coming-of-age tales. Oh, baby, I hear the blues are calling. Tossed salad and scrambled eggs. Laura Coleman is in the studio to talk about home of Fraser Crane, Seattle.
Yes.
Welcome, Laura. How are you?
I'm good. You know, I've never seen an episode of Fraser.
Wow, and they let you in Seattle?
I know.
Let me just put my cards on the table. It's not a good show.
Okay.
Oh, really? Maybe you're not intellectual enough for it.
Yeah, I'm a dumb guy, like Family Guy.
It's pretty weird because Frasier's a spin-off of Cheers.
Yeah.
And Cheers, Fraser Crane is like a barfly.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he's just like this like snooty red wine sip. And they, I don't know if they explain
and
that.
Also, Cheers is set in Boston.
Yeah, yeah, but he leaves. You're allowed to do that. You can move around cities.
They let him
and everyone knows your name.
they stopped him.
I have watched a lot of Grey's Anatomy, which is also set in Seattle.
Ah, yeah, right? Seattle Grey's.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Sleepless in Seattle, seen that one?
Yes.
It's a good flick.
It's a classic.
There's a lot of, I mean, Seattle's famous for a lot of stuff. Laura, can you tell us why you're in Seattle for how long and what were you doing?
Sure. I was on uni exchange and I was there for 3 months and I was drinking coffees, reading
Starbucks.
Books, going to...
Wearing flannel. Cafes.
I wasn't. Maybe I was wearing flannel. It was actually like quite a warm winter that I was there. So, you know, I was like getting rained on.
Yeah, I was going to say.
I was getting rained
famously
on.
Famously, it's like just rains all the
it's
time.
Gray. Right? It's very grey. Yeah.
Grey's Anatomy.
All right, yeah. That'll do it, folks. That's the show.
We've
gone full circle.
So, yeah. Okay, University of what, Washington?
Yeah, Uni of Washington.
Interesting.
I was on exchange.
What were you studying?
I was studying history. I did a lot of American history and also American literature. I thought, you know, went in Rome.
History.
I'll just get into it.
Beautiful.
Can I remember anything that I learnt in my undergrad history degree? No, of course not. But, you know, it was good at the time.
You were college life, living in dorms, partying it up, joining a frat, rushing a frat?
No, I wasn't rushing. I didn't do – I had a bit of that experience, but I lived in an apartment that was on campus, so kind of like a sort of big kids version of that.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
It's like when you stay at a hostel but you get a private room.
It was exactly like that, Drew. Yeah, like perfect. That. Yeah, it was like three or four other girls and we lived in an apartment on campus, but we didn't have like – dorms or like we weren't next to the food hall or whatever you call it. Yeah. I was thinking about Sab's episode when I was remembering about this and I was like, yeah, the main thing was just like the uni experience is so wild and so all-encompassing and it's like you become this kind of like creature that like lives and breathes the uni and you
it's its whole society there because I've probably brought this up before, but I stayed for a little bit on the UCLA campus and we stayed with people who were at the uni and I was like just turned 21 and so we're all kind of like they were students and so they would bring us into the food like the mess hall and then you go to like the football field and stuff and it's like I was standing on the football field like this is better than the Canberra Raiders home field and it's a fucking uni it's nuts.
Yeah the facility is really good, like free gym. People who stayed in dorms, often they would pay and get like the meal package or whatever. So you just go eat at the mess hall whenever you want. About half of my notes are about the different things I ate.
Sloppy
Joe.
Yeah.
Jamie's like, we probably got the same research.
I spent one beautiful day in Seattle in my travels. Okay. Yeah. It was great. We went up from Portland. We stayed a day and a night in a hostel. We made... We annoyed everyone by making constant jokes about seeing Fraser and Niles.
So nothing's changed.
No. No. It could be the whole podcast.
When you say annoyed everyone, you mean
everyone we
people?
Came into contact
right,
with.
So you're just going up to randoms and are you Fraser Crane?
At bars and stuff, being like, Fraser, come in here. And they're like, drink your fucking beer. We went to a couple of dive bars. It was awesome. We got some very nice food, like hush puppies and stuff like that. And then on the way back to the hostel, we stumbled upon a sex store, an adult store. And, you know, like in Newtown, like a sex store is like upstairs and barely marked. And then it's just like fucking porno everywhere. And like,
yeah, we know.
Yeah. You guys know, right?
I have no idea.
No. Well, everyone knows your name when I walk in there.
Yeah.
Hey, Drew!
But this one was like a, I guess the word, like, not like woke is a bad way to describe it, but it was like an enlightened, like, female queer run sex store that was like about, like, it wasn't just like rows and rows of like big butt porno, you know? Like it was just, it was like toys and talking
small
about
butt porno.
Yeah, it was about petite bottoms. Yeah.
Any size butt porno.
But they were, so it was a queer female owned sex store that was about like education and like finding pleasure in toys. And we walked in just as they were doing like a seminar on using bondage stuff for the first time. And they were just like, do you guys want to join the seminar? And we're like, yeah, sure. Yeah. I was like, I'm meeting my friend Niles in a minute.
I'm going to get my salad tossed.
I'm just there for the scrambled eggs, personally.
Like, but scramble your eggs.
Yeah, no, so we listened to a seminar where they had, like, they passed around, like, spurs and stuff, and you put the, you dug them into, like, your arm so you could figure out how they feel. Yeah.
Like a cowboy thing.
Yeah, exactly like that.
Why?
And
what?
It's like for pain and pleasure and stuff.
God,
feels pretty nice. It's kind of like a, yeah, maybe this has unlocked something in me. I remember like it definitely did. And like a friend I was with, like they passed like around ropes and he tied it around himself. And he was like, this feels oddly right. We're like, let's get him out of here before he buys all the rope in Seattle. But then at one point they were handing around like a candle and we were just like, candle? And so, like, I went to smell it, obviously, thinking it was a scented candle. No smell. Passed it to my mate. He did the same thing. So, yeah. And then we pass it to my third mate, who was already unlocked. And we look at him, and he's just pouring wax onto his arm, being like, ooh. And we're like, you freak, don't do that in front of them. But then they're all like, no, no, that is what you're supposed to be doing. Why are you smelling it, you gigantic nerds? And then on the way back, oh, we went to Pike Place Market, which was awesome, bustling, good food. And then on the way back, we realized that it was one of the states where weed is legal. So we asked a guy where a dispensary was, and he was like, you have to kind of go like out of the city to get to the good ones. We didn't really have that much time, so he was just like, here, you can smoke this joint. One of the most powerful things I've ever smoked. About halfway through, I was catatonic, and then I went to the vending machine, got a Baby Ruth bar, which I think is like a picnic bar, and then sat in bed and ate it for what felt like 4.5 hours. Like this, just like...
So you just had one puff of some random guy's joint.
It was like about a quarter of a joint, and it like
knocked
me. That's
very not Jamie Kirk.
Yeah, well, you know, we're fucking overseas, and when it's legal... That gets me off. When it's illegal, that does get me off.
I can't believe you and your mates just went for a little cheeky kink seminar in the middle of your holiday, and then you just hung out
but
afterwards.
Sometimes like that's like the coolest stuff about like a day tour, because we were just like, we had looked up like bars and restaurants, and then we're just walking, and we're like, let's go in there. Because it was like a sex, like I've been in Australian sex stores and they're usually like pretty dark and dingy. This was like, this looked like a, like an open home. Like it was like all like glass and like hardwood floors and stuff.
Like it's
it was,
borders or something.
Yeah. And it was on like the ground floor. Like you could see into it from the street.
That's
and
very
so we did a we did a little kink. We had a little kink cinema. So now, if you need to know anything about BDSM, I am the man.
Nice, Jamie. That's very Seattle. Like it's very progressive. It's very like not woke. I hate the word woke, but it's like very progressive, left wing, liberal. Yeah. Like anything goes.
Is there anything good about it? Or?
That's the first Starbucks. might be more up your own.
Yeah, no, I love big business. Not when they unionize.
Did you were you, where's the campus in like in the city? Was it sort of out in the sticks a little bit, or was it right in the guts of
the
city?
No, it's pretty much in the city. Yeah, right in the thick of it. I did do a little bit of travel around, like tried to go to all the neighborhoods, like, you know, it was a bit like, I guess I want to say Melbourne, in that they have like little neighborhoods where this is the live music neighborhood, or this is a like this type of food neighborhood, and just turned around and saw some bands, ate some food.
I've got a list of places, and this, a lot of them are in one particular neighborhood, which I'm sure you're familiar with, but I want to know if you've visited any of these. They're kind of like landmarks slash some are like public artworks. They're all very like
Fraser's house,
kind of kooky.
the coffee shop Fraser goes to.
Niles.
The first one is the Troll, the Fremont Troll.
Yes,
you've seen
the
it.
Troll. Yep.
So for anyone who doesn't know, this is like, it's described as, below Seattle's bustling Aurora Bridge lies a towering creature with long gangly fingers, a single shiny metal eye, and a curtain of stringy hair. So it's like, they've basically built a statue thing of this weird bridge troll, like under a bridge, and he's holding on to a Volkswagen Beetle that's an actual like crashed car that they put under there. Cool. So it's like he's like ripped it off the bridge.
Oh, that's it.
And it's huge. Like, this thing is fucking massive.
Damn.
It's very cool. Then we have the Fremont Rocket.
I don't remember the Rocket.
The Rocket is a sculpture. Basically, it's in Fremont. Again, Fremont, from what I can gather, is kind of the quirky, artsy neighborhood.
Yeah, yeah, right? Yeah. That sounds right.
So this is like, it's just, it's effectively, it just looks like a Cold War rocket. Like, it's about to launch. It's, again, it's huge, and it's just right there in the middle of, in the neighborhood. There's the Gum Wall, which is a wall in Post Alley, which is adjacent to the box office for the Market Theater, which is a venue for comedy shows and small performances. And basically, it seems just like one of those things that started, people would just leave shows and they'd be chewing gum and they'd stick it on the wall. And it kind of just over time became a thing. And now it's like people go there to put their gum on the wall. Okay. And it's like, it's pretty, like, it looks disgusting.
Yeah,
it's,
that's gross.
It's like a gross version of those like locket fences. Yes. You know what I mean? Yes.
I've also read that some people pick the gum off the wall and put it back in their mouths. Shows up in like Seattle, like weird eccentric people. Just
kind
like
of it. Like their version of Trough Man or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Like
yeah.
Gum Man.
Okay.
And then my favorite of all of them, is the giant 16-foot statue of Lenin? Lenin.
Yeah, of course, which, I've seen the statue of Lenin.
16 foot.
And it's got, like, it's kind of interesting because, I assumed forever, cause I just always knew about Seattle had Fremont, and the statue of Lenin was the only one that I just knew of from just general popular culture. And I assumed the entire time that it was like Seattle being, we're like, we're lefties, like we've got a big statue of Lenin. But it's kind of like got a bit of a more interesting history than that. It was created in 1988 by a Slovakian sculptor as part of an arts competition. And it was in, I think, Slovakia. And then in 1989, obviously there's revolution, the Soviet Union collapses, and it was toppled. And this random dude, an entrepreneur from Issaquah in Washington State, this dude called Lou Carpenter, he was just traveling through Slovakia and he saw it and was like, that fucking rules. I want to bring it home. So he bring it back to Issaquah.
Imagine checking that in your luggage.
It's a bit more than 30
just
kilos.
Squeezing it above your fucking seat.
So like I said, he brought it home and he tried to sell it on and no one would buy it. And then he was just like,
is that Lenin's statue still available on Marketplace? No bites.
I'll give you 50 for it.
Do you deliver? And he eventually sold it on to a kind of a community group type thing. And they erected it in this square. And if you see it, it is like you would think for all intents and purposes, it's a public artwork. And there's always been, you know, controversy because it's like, oh, why would you put this statue of a dictator up, blah, 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 this and that. There are people fighting over it. But Lou Carpenter's always maintained that if you look at the statue, like, it's not Lenin being, like, sort of valorized. He's got this, like, aggressive posture. And he's like, no, it's anti-Lenin.
Oh.
Like,
right, okay.
And also people are like, how dare the government spend money? They should tear it down. And there's, you know, recent years with, like, Confederate statues and stuff, it's like, tear them all down. But it's, even though it looks like it's just on a sidewalk, it's actually private land. So nobody, you can't tear it down.
Right.
They privately have this land. They put it up and they're like, you cannot touch it.
Damn. Interesting. But it's still a tourist attraction.
It's a huge tourist attraction. Right. It's 16 foot. It's huge. And it's just like, it's like a kind of on a corner of an intersection. You've looked, if that's,
Yeah.
That's what the picture
I think I have a picture
like.
Of me with it.
Nice. I mean, I'm a big Cold War nerd, so I like between the fucking rocket and the Lenin statue, I definitely want to do a little whirlwind tour of this place.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Awesome. Yeah, I also went to the park where they filmed the scene in 10 Things I Hate About You where Julia Stiles and Heath Ledger are hitting each other with the paint. The paintball, that's also in Seattle. Really? I think in Fremont as well.
Well, I've read that the bridge troll thing is in 10 Things I Hate About You in a scene with, oh mate, not Heath Ledger, but the other
Joseph
one.
Gordon-Levitt.
Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Yeah.
Which I didn't remember that scene. Like, I feel like a giant bridge troll would be something I'd remember from that movie.
I think it's with him and he's with Larissa Olenek and they're talking about like the prom or something.
Okay, right. Yeah.
So it's one of my favorite films.
It's not a scene where it's like, hey, check out this big troll.
No, the troll is a bit player, unfortunately. Yeah.
Speaking of Cold War, then Seattle, and you say very progressive city and all that sort of stuff, but it is home to a quarter of America's 9,000 nuclear weapons.
What?
20 miles north of Seattle at the naval base, Hood Canal Naval Base, Kitsap, Bangor. It's got all the submarine nuclear weapons, a quarter of them there. And this is what caught my fancy. This Drewy will love this, right? Because they have a new batch of sentries that they hired to monitor the base. But they will not have to wear uniforms. They won't get to clock out for breaks, but they will be paid in fish.
What? Oh, the dolphins.
20 bottlenose dolphins and 20 and 40 California sea lions patrol the shoreline around the base to
that
protect
the submarines.
That is awesome.
I hope they're armed
that
as well.
Rules.
So this is really cool. So they basically, the animals will be on lookout 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for swimmers or divers in the bay's restricted water. So they just basically do
just
laps.
Picturing a dolphin holding a submachine gun. One of those little hats.
Well, they go into
someone can draw that, please.
They go into detail of how it works, right? So it says, we enlisted marine mammals because of modern technology had not yet caught up with their innate sensory abilities. So dolphins have a superior biological sonar than anything that we can develop and allows them to find mines and swimmers for the Navy. The sea lions also have excellent low light vision, underwater directional hearing capabilities, and retrieval missions are also unlikely.
But it's not like they can radio back. Like, what do they
do? What, when they notice that, what are they? Yeah, do they just kill and eat the people?
Yeah, well, they've thought of this as well. Okay. So unlike human divers, obviously the animals can go down for a long time. So what happens is when they go out and patrol, the animals are accompanied by handlers in small boats, right? If the dolphin senses an intruder, so they go for a dive. If they sense an intruder, they swim back up to the boat, and they touch a sensor on the boat to alert the handler. This is the coolest part, though. The handlers and the military personnel decide if it's necessary to investigate, and if so, what they do is they place a strobe light or some sort of noisemaker on the dolphin's nose. The dolphin is trained to swim up to the intruder again, bump into the intruder, which knocks it off the dolphin's nose and like lands where the swimmer is, and then swims away and the military personnel take over. So the dolphin goes and basically like just tags them.
Okay.
But this is even better. The sea lions are trained slightly differently. Sea lions are trained to swim up to the intruder with a cuff held in the sea lion's mouth. And when it bumps up against the intruder's leg, the cuff snaps shut on the intruder. So the sea lions have little handcuffs that they go up in there and attach to the people. And then they swim away and the military personnel take over.
The sea lions learned something at the bondage workshop.
Yeah, exactly like that.
They knew how to operate a candle.
There you go,
That fucking rules. I love animals with jobs.
Oh, it's the best.
It sounds like something out of a James Bond movie. Mm.
I think even if that was in a James Bond movie, I'd be like, ridiculous. Yeah.
I think it was in like some James Bond movie in the 80s and everyone was like lasers, or maybe that was just Austin Powers.
Well, Austin Powers is sharks with freaking lasers.
But I think, I don't know, I think that was a reference to Bond, there is real, really out there. They're training them, man.
Man, that's the fucking rules.
Laura, so tell us about this food.
Well, the main thing that I noticed was like the difference between people who were sort of in their 20s in Australia. You know, you go to uni, you live in maybe a share house near uni, you're learning how to cook for yourself, mm-hmm. you're learning how to do everything for yourself for the first time. When I left home at like 18, 19, I couldn't cook, and like my first housemates had to give me like a cookbook and be like, please, like, you need this. Then eventually, you know, it all came together. But at uni in the US, at college or whatever, they like don't really do that stuff. They just live in these dorms and they just go to this place and eat the food and then they go to the place. And then they go to the gym and do that and then they go to their frat house. It seems very much more organized and more structured or whatever. So, like, I just remember once I was making pasta. So the apartment I lived in had a kitchen and it had everything you would need to, you know, kind of look after yourself. But none of the other girls I lived with really used the kitchen. And, like, one of them, one time I was making pasta and I remember I had, like, the colander in the sink and then the pasta had finished cooking on the stove and I, like, poured the boiling water with the pasta into the colander and all the steam came up and she was in there and she was like, whoa. Like, she never...
Surely a child's over here.
Yeah, she, like, never cooked pasta. She was like, whoa, what's that? I'm like, just pasta, babe. Like, but... Yeah, it was crazy to
me. The toast pops. He's like, holy shit. Holy shit. The toaster exploded.
And now it's brown.
And we had like a potluck at our apartment one time and I made like a Indian curry or something. And like one of the other girls brought like a few cans of soups and like opened them.
Oh my God.
And that was her contribution to the potluck. Okay, this is different. Like this is very culturally different to what I'm used to.
Can you do the trick where you put the cold soup and make steam come out?
Laura's a magician.
Yeah.
They're just like, pouring it into the colander being like, it's just going into the sink, Laura.
Yeah, but I guess like when you go to the dining hall and you have like every food you could possibly want, including like, you know, pizza, pasta, burgers, this, that. You're like, burritos, nachos. Why would you learn to cook?
Did you guys always feel like when you're at school and you watch cartoons, American cartoons, and they all had cafeterias, were you jealous of that? I feel like at school you'd be jealous. I understand your point about uni. It's like, let's learn how to cook.
Yeah, yeah.
But when you're like 13...
Yeah,
and the kids would go in and they get food on a tray.
Oh, for sure.
Versus whatever
a meat
shit
pie
mom put in
plastic.
Whatever loving meal my mum's made me in my lunch, you know, like some lovely ham sandwich that I was like, well, don't need
throw
this
it
shit.
Straight
yeah,
trash.
Yeah. But I feel like at some point that's got to stop, right? Yeah. Like,
what did you guys? What was a standard packed lunch for you? Because I had the same shit every day. It was, and by shit, I mean it was delightful. Thanks, Vicky. it was like
caviar again.
It was for recess, just like one of those mini packets of chips, whatever flavor. You know, you buy the ones with the little packets in there, and a little like mini chocolate, like a Mars bar or a Milky Way, or something. Recess done, and then lunch, just straight up Vegemite sandwich every day.
Mm. Every day.
Every day. Yeah.
Well, it would be a 3-course meal, but but it would be that. Well, there would be some sort of sandwich. A roll up, sort of like treat-ish.
Oh, I love a roll up.
Love a roll up. Yeah. That was your king.
Okay. Oh, occasionally one of those biscuits where you scoop the cheese.
Le snacks.
Oh, yeah.
You're eating like a king that day. You know.
Dunkaroos.
Oh, I never got those. Take me back. You never got a Dunkaroo?
I've had
like
them.
A chocolate Le snack.
Yeah. Oh. Like I have had them, but they were very much like a rarity.
Yeah, James.
I was not a big recess person. I wouldn't have had anything at recess.
Okay, doing the fasting diet.
Yeah, intermittent fasting. For lunch, it would have been the same thing every day, which would have been like a cheese roll, sometimes with like a little deli meat in it, but mostly just cheese and butter.
Cheese and butter.
Mm. Wow, and then
simple.
Yeah, but like you sound exactly like my mate Maddie White, shout out, whose mum like lovingly every day, and like he'd open it and be like, fuck. This isn't even my favorite kind of LCA.
Yeah. You got the wrong type of treat. Yeah.
No, I had like, same roll with a bit of butter and Vegemite or cheese and ham or whatever.
I think that's changed now. Like, I think you'll see kids like taking like bento boxes with like sushi and stuff.
And they have like a lot of like chopped up like fret, you know, carrot and celery stuff in little compartments.
Yeah, you got to diversify. No fruit roll-ups. I think fruit roll-ups are
my nieces and nephews eat with like such an advanced palate. They're like 2 years old. I'm like, I didn't have that food till I was 25.
Yeah.
Insane.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Vegemite sandwich every day.
Not in the US. It's a very dumbed down palate.
Yeah.
Right. So I remember one time just thinking, I made friends with a few international students, obviously, and one of my friends, Mia, who lived in like rural Victoria. And her idea for dinner at the dining hall was to get pizza, but then to also get fries.
Disgusting.
Mm.
So to have pizza and fries, and I was just like, she's a genius.
What's I would have treat? So much acid reflux, like my head would melt.
I did gain weight, like, and I think that's quite normal. They call
the freshman 15.
So everyone was...
I don't get, like, I do understand that America's, you know, famously has an obesity problem, but I don't understand how anyone there is skinny. because you just like the food options are terrible. And if it's healthy, it's like, oh, I'll get a salad. It comes drenched in fucking ranch dressing.
And it's the size too. It's not even it's the volume.
Yeah, it's insane.
You get a salad and it's this.
Yeah, it rocks.
I feel like you can kind of do it to yourself. Like if you wanted to eat healthy at the dining hall, you could. There were salads and you can put your own dressing on, right? But because like, I guess Mia would have been like living with her parents in Victoria. She was just like, I can have whatever I want for dinner. I'm going to have pizza and I'm going to have chips. Like, why wouldn't I do that?
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, babe. Like,
I do also think that is a little bit of a tourist thing about America, being like, there's nothing healthy here. And it's like, brother, you are standing in McDonald's right now. Like, what do you want? Like, it's the same in Australia, just bigger here.
Like, yeah,
you
but can, even like
there are plenty of restaurants that serve like good, fresh food.
Yeah, even the grocery stores, like the you know, produce there doesn't seem as good as in Australia.
Mm.
Yeah, I think for me, I was leaning into it. I was like, oh, whoa, the food's so cheap and you get so much. Oh, I'm putting on a few kilos. Oh, well, when in Rome. Like, yeah, just kind of using it as an excuse to just...
When in Rome was the real, like, catchphrase of your time over there, it sounds like.
It was, which was funny because I was in Seattle. Maybe I should have gone to Italy. Yeah.
Was there any local delicacies or local weird things that they had for food? Like...
They were really into fish and seafood, which I wasn't so much into at the time.
All the people guarding the Navy base, I assume, were really into sardines.
Yeah. I think I went to the trout farm, just to the trout, like, hatchery or something, just to have a look at the big fish. But I didn't, I didn't really get into the seafood. I went to Pike Place Market, obviously. That was sick. And I did go to the first Starbucks and have an espresso.
Do people there... Like, are they proud of Starbucks or
they? I think they are. Like, I think yes and no. I think they're proud of like the coffee culture that it's sort of.
Yeah.
They have good coffee there. Like, they don't. I don't remember ever going and getting like a diner style coffee, like a mug with just that was just filled up. Everywhere has espresso. But yeah, I guess people were critical of what Starbucks had become and that.
That would take away one of the biggest advantages as an Australian to go. Which is when you go to America to be like, the coffee sucks.
No.
Australia is the only thing that we can claim when we go to America is like being clearly better in Seattle. It doesn't sound like you can do that, right?
Nah.
Oh, that sucks.
I got a little something. This is a real life superhero patrolling the streets of Seattle. This is also kind of, there's a lot of stuff about this guy. And there is a whole podcast about him called The Superhero Complex. So you can listen to that for a long, detailed version. For a funny version that takes about 5 minutes and is inaccurately researched, you can listen right now. This is like a little article from the Sydney Morning Herald by a guy called Barry Davola, and he's basically like promoting the podcast. He was interviewing the guy. This is a guy named David Weinberg was nervous when you have $4,000 in an envelope and you're meant to hand it over to a guy who is a mixed martial arts fighter and a real-life costumed superhero who may or may not be a drug addict. You do tend to get the jitters. Weinberg, a journalist based in Los Angeles, has been commissioned to make The Superhero Complex, a podcast about a man named Phoenix Jones, who spent his evenings dressed in a black and gold hood and protective bodysuit, which includes stab-proof chest plates and was said to be bulletproof. It also had a nightstick and taser in his utility belt and pepper spray. So he would patrol the streets of Seattle and he would break up drunken fights, help people in distress, and stop crime. In real life, his name was Ben Fodor, who had a background working with autistic children. But so this guy's meant to meet him, but he was proving elusive. He kept ghosting Weinberg, standing him up and coming up with excuses. Meanwhile, Weinberg was interviewing people who knew him, including fellow team members in the group Jones had led, the Rain City Superhero Movement. They had names such as El Caballero, Midnight Jack, and Purple Rain, spelled R-E-I-G-N, and were more than willing to dish the dirt, telling Weinberg that Jones was an egoist, a bully, a fame seeker, and a drug addict. Then
is this like a, open mic comedy gossip, but it's superhero?
Yeah, so it is like, so this guy formed a superhero, like an Avengers, in Seattle, and then I think the other guys kind of didn't like him, and we're just like, yeah, this fucking guy.
Our experience says, don't mess with Midnight Jack, by the way. That's a guy with too much energy.
Midnight Jack, his superpower is picking up anything off the streets and putting it in his nose. But then this guy, Jones, he finally showed up at Weinberg's hotel, and he totally surprised me, says Weinberg. I've been reading all about his exploits, and I knew he was in the MMA world, but I opened the door, and he was wearing a checked shirt and a fanny pack, and he looked like a bit of a nerd. He didn't seem at all like the crazy person other people had described. He was smart and charismatic, and he was very open with me. He gave me contacts for other people to talk to. After 3 hours, which was more than the agreed interview time, he agreed to give me more time for nothing. In case you're wondering about the $4,000 in that envelope, it was payment for a 3-hour sit-down interview. Weinberg said there was another payment of $2,000 for being taken out on patrol with Jones. So, I'd never paid anyone for an interview before this, Weinberg admits, but the agreement had been made by the podcast production company before he signed on to the project. With that said, I personally don't have a big issue with it. In fact, I've often felt that sources should get paid for their time. A little bit of journalism ethics stuff sprinkled in there. So like all the best superheroes, Jones has a tragic origin story and fatal flaws. He was adopted out when he was an infant, his mother was a drug dealer, and his father was shot and killed while he was trying to rob a convenience store. And also, as for the
this
story,
guy is Batman, right? Like, yeah, yeah. Even ghosting the, it's like ghosting Gordon, you know, like the, what's his name? Commissioner Gordon.
I don't think it's in this article, but I did read another article of like, because this story has been going on for like 10 years. So like now you'll see kind of like the worm turn, but in 2011, there was like a GQ article where he like tailed him for a day. Mm. And the first time he met him, he was in hospital because he was pissing nothing but blood because it just had the shit kicked out of him interrupting a fight. But Damn. Like he went out on patrol with him and the other members of the Rain City superhero team. And it is quite an interesting read, but it's also very long. You might remember that I mentioned that a lot of people have accused Jones of having a problem with drugs. True. He was arrested in 2020 for trying to sell MDMA to an undercover police officer, and he was found with cocaine in his possession. So Phoenix is definitely the most arrogant of the superheroes I met, says Weinberg, but I genuinely think that all the ones I interviewed, Phoenix included, essentially have their hearts in the right place. They're out there because they want to do good and help people. The majority of them were largely doing humanitarian aid, helping the homeless. And all of them are anti-firearm and don't believe in carrying guns. But, I mean, there are also rumors that Phoenix Jones got into trouble once for breaking up a fight by pepper spraying the entire fight, and then it came out that there was no fight. He just pepper sprayed a random group of people. towards the end of the podcast production, Weinberg sent multiple emails to Jones to get his responses to the criticisms that had been leveled at him by the other superheroes. These included accusations of hubris and bullying, plus claims that he was using his fame to fuel a drug habit and that he incited fights with people, including the aforementioned pepper spraying an innocent group outside of a nightclub. He ignored Weinberg's questions for weeks. Then at the 11th hour, this is my absolute favorite detail of this story. At the 11th hour, he gets back to him and says, "Sorry, man, I've been too busy to answer. I am trying to get a visa so I can go and fight in Ukraine."
Oh, hell yeah.
Jesus Christ. You're not going to do well with pepper spray. Yeah. Fucking Russian.
Also, you might remember, so that comment is obviously quite recent because the Russia-Ukraine war. You might remember that I just said in 2020 he got arrested for selling drugs to an undercover police officer. So Weinberg said, "I don't think he can even leave the country because he's on felony probation. But who knows? You never know what to believe with Phoenix. It wouldn't surprise me if he was genuinely trying to get a visa. I would love nothing more than to turn on the news and see Phoenix Jones running at a Russian tank. That would make my day." After the final episode of the Superhero Complex dropped in May, there was a live event planned in LA with Weinberg and a Zoom hookup with many of the superheroes from the podcast. Jones was invited to take part, but said he would only make an appearance if they paid to fly him to LA so he could be there in person. When Weinberg explained that wasn't possible, he wrote back, "Okay, I haven't listened to the show, but people are telling me it's not positive." Weinberg responded by saying he thought the podcast was fair and he hoped he would listen to it. Jones wrote back, positive or not, life is what it is.
Mm. Damn, too right, brother.
Yeah.
Okay. Wise words, deep. Yeah.
Phoenix Jones.
At least of all the kooky local drug dealy nutbags, that's not a bad story, yeah, no, right? Yeah. Like, he's out there trying to break up fights.
I mean, like,
the
GQ one goes into detail about, like, different superheroes from different cities as well. And, like, there is a guy, I think, I might be wrong about this location-wise, but I think it's in New York where, like, he would just, like, find, like, people dealing weed in the park and just shout in their face, being like, "You're dealing weed! That's illegal! That's illegal! That's illegal!" until they'd run off. And that's his superpower, being annoying.
Being a nerd.
Yeah.
Wow. It's interesting that you said that this guy was, like, anti-guns or whatever, because that was something that I noticed. Even though Seattle is very progressive, the attitude towards guns was still kind of positive. Like, I've got some notes about this, but when I was there, I started getting more politically involved, you know, a very lefty city, living on campus. And I'd done some stuff in Sydney, mostly, like, I was involved in environmental politics and stuff. But then when I got to Seattle, I, like, started getting involved in, like, I went to this anarchist study group that met in a bookstore, and we would drink coffee, and it was mostly just, like, American grad students. And then one day I turned up and was like, "Oh, you's reading about anarchism, eh?" And they were like, "What? Yeah, okay." You can, like, it was pretty weird for me to go. But anyway, and yeah, like, they, I remember ending up talking about, like, guns with them, and I just assumed that they would be, like, really anti-gun because they were left-wing, but they were like, "Oh, no, like, you know, everyone has the right to, you know, this." I was like, "What?" So, yeah, just, like, really crazy differences around very fundamental issues.
I've heard that the state of Washington,
super red.
It's like, outside of Seattle, it's like just the wild west. Yeah, like, it's like, that's where, like guns, and it's like that, like,
Armand Bundy.
I don't believe in the government's ability to tax me. Yeah. Wild stuff. Is that Armand Bundy? Is that one of the guys?
I think his name's Armand Bundy. Yeah, even Oregon's the same. Like, outside of Portland, it's like just super, super libertarian.
Yeah, libertarians, right?
All ranches and shit.
Yeah, I did see. Just speaking of, you know, that, like you said, progressive. And there's obviously, you know, good progressive, and then there's sort of hippy-dippy, off-the-spectrum progressive. And this is a lady there called Naveena Shine in the article. And I don't know if it's a real name or not, but she's leaning into it because Naveena Shine, the article is called "Living on Light, Woman Attempts to Prove Humans Can Live Without Food." 65-year-old Seattle woman is attempting to go 100 days on just water, shunning all medical advice in the process.
This babe just hasn't been down to the dining hall and seen the options that are available. Get her some pizza, get her some chips.
Well, she says, you know, we like food, we enjoy food, but we don't need food. She says she believes it's possible for human beings to survive without food, and is conducting what she describes as an experiment to prove it. Other people have previously claimed to survive without food and even water, and no one's ever been able to prove it. And Dr. Ronald Hoffman goes into this article saying, it's delusion to think you can escape the laws of biology, because her whole thing is plants get energy from sunlight. We can convert sunlight into energy too. We just don't need food, and we don't do that because we don't go long enough without food for our body to kick in. That's her theory. Mm-hmm. And he's saying,
so you don't eat long enough, you gain the ability to photosynthesize.
Exactly. So he says plants have what called chloroplasts that contain chlorophyll and have the ability to capture energy from sunlight. Humans do not have that. It is impossible. Therefore, it is you need fat, protein, or carbohydrates to make energy, not sunlight. And the doctor says if Shine continues not to eat food, her organs will fail and she will die. Shine contends a doctor can't see living on light because he looks through a different lens at the world. And she said she's not undergoing medical tests as part of the experiment. She says she's experienced a calling which inspires her to stop eating. It came as an idea that became so powerful I knew I had to do it. And I suddenly got this strong desire to do it. This is what I need to do. It's intuition. Four people have reportedly died attempting to assist on sunlight alone, mainly influenced by a little bit of and I think this would be a great Patreon dive because I started touching on this other character, but it's too detailed. But there's a Brisbane woman called Ellen Grieve who prefers to be known as Jasmuheen, and she basically wrote this book called Living on Light. Jasmuheen says, generally I don't eat any food at all. Every now and then I'll have a cup of tea and a glass of water. So this woman says she doesn't even need water, right? This is a Brisbane woman. So she wrote a book about it and all these people followed her advice and four of them died, right? But I love some of these details. She says, sometimes I feel a bit bored. This is the Brisbane woman. Sometimes I feel a bit bored and I want some flavor or something. So then I'll have a mouthful of chocolate or a mouthful of cheesecake or something. You can tell she's just starving her guts out. Just like,
but then, so I was like, I don't eat. Occasionally I will eat.
I'll stuff my face with cheesecake. But she says, visitors to, this is a Brisbane woman, so she wanted 60 minutes to try to prove she could live without food, which goes exactly how you imagine it would go. But visitors, I love this line, visitors to a large villa in the prosperous Chapel Hill area of Brisbane invariably find her refrigerator generously stocked with food, all of it destined, she insists, for the stomach of her second husband, Jeff Ferguson, a convicted fraudster. So then back to Naveena. So Naveena Shine, she was trying to do 100 days. How long do you guys reckon she went? And I'll spoil it for you. She did not make 100 days.
Yeah. Well, there goes my guess.
She didn't die.
I'm going to say she went 6 days. No, 10 days. 10 days.
3.
Oh, you guys are way off. Naveena Shine has decided to stop her attempt at fasting after 44 days.
Wow.
So Naveena did pretty well, but some of the coping afterwards is so great. She said the overt reason for ending what she described as an experiment was financial. She claimed she will lose the trailer. She has been staying in a Wednesday, and she says that her monetary woes were a simple message from the universe that it's time to stop. I don't know how you're losing money not eating food, woman, but here we go.
You're saving money.
So she's saying that after 47 days, again, some of the editing on this like article is great. So this is what Naveena wrote on her Facebook blog, and in brackets, it's got the editor's correction. After 47 days, the post was written after 44 days. So she's adding days on. I still feel really good. Weight loss is slowing and all seems well. However, I still have no evidence that I'm actually living on light and it could well be a slow starvation. Now that I'm ending the experiment, I will never know. So she's trying to be like, listen, we never really figured it out. So she said that she had not been undergoing tests, but her weight dropped from 159 pounds to 126 pounds, which is like 15 kilos or something like that she lost. And she said she would stop her fast if her weight dropped below 120, but she didn't even, that she pulled the plug at 44. She admitted in a video at 4 weeks that she needed more rest than usual, could not get up too quickly, experienced leg cramps. She complained of lightheadedness, nausea. Her extremities felt cold. And commentators have been a mixture of people who believe living on light is possible and others urging her to stop. She said that she did not eat the entire time. She started adding a dietary supplement to her water because she was finding it hard to drink water because it was so hard to keep. Because her body was needing food so much. She was needing to flavor her water to drink it because she was like, she was just so craving food that all she was having was water, right? She says, it's from the feedback I'm getting, it's become patently clear that the world, most of the world is by no means ready to receive the information I am attempting to produce. Even if it were true that a person...
Including me.
Even if it were true that a person can live on light and I was successful in demonstrating that, I see that it would be synonymous with putting a non-driver behind the wheel of a huge truck. It would be an accident in the making. I don't understand this logic. She's trying to say like it's too powerful to prove it's true, so I can't. I'm going to stop it now. In a YouTube video, she said there are many, many complex reasons for ending the experiment. Because I'm closing it does not mean to say there's any failure here. I'm looking healthy. I feel healthy, bouncing with energy. None of the dire predictions that people said were going to happen. But she did say that I have no idea if I could complete the 100 days. Personally, do I think it's possible for me? It's still a question. I see much evidence to show that, yes, it's possible, but I'm not willing to risk my life or other people's lives. I would say that living on light experiment has been amazingly successful. It did not do what I thought it was going to do, but it did do what existence wanted it to do. That is what I call perfect. The biggest cope ever.
That is awesome.
Very, very calculating.
Such a good way of weaseling out of I was wrong. Like, you weren't ready to receive the information that I was giving you. I'm going to try that.
I know. I might use that.
Come off stage after a fresh bomb. It's like, you guys weren't ready for a crush.
Yeah. They weren't ready for my information.
Booker, that was perfect.
Far out. Yeah. I remember trying to do it. Like a juice cleanse,
or
like a viral thing that went around. Me and my girlfriend at the time, this is like fucking you know,
15, this wasn't a coconut cleanse, was it, Joey?
15 years ago. No, no. The coconut cleanse is where I have the coconut and she cleanses me.
It's an old bit that Drew got dumped for opening the coconut.
Yeah. I do remember that. R.I.P.
No, we did. It was just like, you know, you order it off the TV and it's like you drink like this. You have this, you know, weird juicy thing and it's supposed to be like just 24 hours or maybe 48 hours. And all you have is this liquid and it's supposed to have all your nutrients or whatever. And it's like it flushes out all the bad shit and whatever. Anyway, so her and I like mix up the first batch. We have our little juice or whatever. We're like probably an hour and a half into doing this. And we're watching an episode of Entourage and they were all having lunch. And like the food looked so good but they were eating that I immediately went and made spaghetti. I didn't even last 2 hours.
Oh my God. Everyone lasts 2 hours. 2 hours
without eating every day.
I can't eat quicker than 2 hours. I can't eat that fast. That's the worst attempt. The world record at the
Drew,
worst fast.
It wasn't a failure.
The world
raging
was ready.
Success.
To you, it was perfect.
And spaghetti, you got to cook it. You got, like, it's not like it was just like a packet of Tim Tams and you're like, I can't help myself.
That's what they were eating. That's what fucking Vinny was eating.
You got to have your housemate come out when you drain the spaghetti. And go, yeah.
Well, I got to eat it now. Look at this.
How
steam.
Much did the juice cleanse cost? Do you know?
No, I don't remember. It was probably like prohibitively expensive. It's probably like $100 or something.
Did you then, were you like, after you ate the spaghetti, were you like, okay, we slipped back to juice? Or were you like, no, spaghetti.
Juice straight in the bin.
Spaghetti straight in the mouth.
Yeah, absolutely.
I definitely thought that was going to be a time I shit myself story.
No,
it was
no,
very
no.
disappointing.
Lord knows I got plenty of those.
Yeah.
After the spaghetti.
Well, Vinny shit his pants after the spaghetti. I got another story here from the New Yorker. It's about a real life beer baron, ooh, otherwise known as a bootlegger, but I think beer baron's better, cooler. Yeah. Yeah. So this also is quite interesting because it has like implications on the U.S. privacy law that reached like far into the future. So this is back in, I believe, the 20s. So nearly a century before a U.S. president accused his predecessor of ordering a tap on his private telephone line and before he tweeted a warning to the head of the FBI that he had better hope there are no tapes of our conversations, little Trump bashing up top, liberal media cucks, a professional spy armed with a pack of cigarettes and an earpiece hid in the basement of the Henry Building in downtown Seattle, catching crackling bits of words being spoken miles away. So Richard Fryant had worked as a wiretapper for the New York Telephone Company, tasked with eavesdropping on his own colleagues, and now took freelance assignments in the Queen City. On this occasion, he was seeking dirt on Seattle's corrupt mayor, who is suspected of having ties to Roy Olmsted, a local bootlegger. So he was commissioned to get dirt on the mayor by a political rival as well. So at the behest of his client, Fryant rigged microwires to a certain exchange, Elliot 6785, and began to listen. And here's a little snippet of the conversation. The hell they did. Who asked another? The Federals. The man speaking on Elliot 6785 hung up, but the conversation had only just begun. So criminals and prohibition officials alike called Olmsted the good bootlegger. It was a moniker that reflected his singular business philosophy. He never diluted his whiskey with water. He never put like poison in it to cut it down. He declined to dabble in like the other offshoots that bootleggers often do, such as like drugs and prostitution. He abhorred violence. He forbade all members of his organization from carrying weapons, saying that no amount of money is worth a human life. If people were apprehended, his men were instructed to rely on bribes instead of violence. Olmsted had a particular respect for policemen and the law, because he was a member of the Seattle Police for 13 years.
Whoa.
He got to the rank of...
All cops are bootleggers.
He got to the rank of lieutenant. In 1920, with the onset of Prohibition, the 33-year-old married father of two decided to go quit the force and go all the way to the other side and become a gangster. Because he saw Prohibition coming, he saw that it was kind of lucrative, and also, I believe, was kind of like, this is bullshit. Like, why are we taking away people's booze? I'm going to bring it in and make it good. So he made midnight runs to retrieve imported Canadian liquor from tugboats in the Puget Sound. This practice earned his dismissal from the force and also made him a local celebrity. With his old police colleagues on his payroll, he was free to conduct business brazenly and with impunity, often unloading his booze at high noon from trucks marked Fresh Fish. Seattle citizens were thrilled to glimpse Olmsted on the street, wearing a fine suit and carrying a wallet fat with money, always ready with a joke. As one acquaintance noted, it made a man feel important to casually remark, as Roy Olmsted was telling me today, so kind of like how people at the pub sometimes were like, the latest Communion Intersport episode, Drew said this, and that's a point of pride for people at the local pub. So, Olmsted's organization, composed of an ever-growing staff of attorneys, dispatchers, clerks, skippers, navigators, bottlers, loaders, drivers, delivery men, collectors, and salesmen, they dominated the bootlegging scene in the Pacific Northwest. They relied heavily upon the telephone for day-to-day operations, using it to take orders, communicate updates on deliveries, and warn of impending raids, their words coursing across a web of wires connecting the city's 52,000 devices. So that's one phone for every six United States citizens. So Olmsted set up his communication headquarters in the Henry Building, which is just a block from the federal police. It's pretty cool to just set up right in their backyard. Yeah. And he established three exchanges. One of his men, a former taxi dispatcher, just sat during business hours at a roll-top desk, taking and making calls, keeping meticulous records of each transaction. If a serious matter arose, such as an employee's arrest, Olmsted himself would then call one of his mates on the Seattle police force and have it quashed. At the end of each day, the dispatcher unplugged the three telephones because they would not stop ringing. And then the next morning, would do it all over again.
So are the calls just like, is it like Jimmy Brings? Like, guys, like, hey, I'm having a party, I need some whiskey.
I think it's all of that. So it's like, this is where we're going to get stuff. This is where we're going to deliver stuff. Okay. Hey, someone's about to raid you. Hey, also call the police and tell them Olmsted said, cut it out. And then the police would be like, okay. So, in early 1924, Olmsted was approached by Richard Fryant, who was the freelance wiretapper who had been hunkered down in the basement of the Henry Building, listening to Olmsted's lines. As the bootlegger would soon learn, Seattle's prohibition director, William Whitney, had heard of Fryant's surveillance and recruited him as a federal agent. In Olmsted's version of events, Fryant presented him with a heavy stack of paper explaining that the pages contained verbatim transcripts of conversations that had been conducted on the bootlegger's office phone. For $10,000, Fryant said, the transcripts could be his. So he's been made a federal agent and has gone straight to the person he's investigating and tried to sell back to him. Sick. So Olmsted goes through the papers and is like, oh, fuck, these are real. So here's a call from a cop to a worker at Olmsted's headquarters. Down under the 4th Avenue Bridge is a car with 7 gallons of moonshine in it, and I was wondering if it's yours. No, I don't think it's ours because we don't handle moonshine. And there are other calls where he's like saying like, hey, one of your police officers picked up one of my boys. Just let me know before he's booked. And the guy's like, Roy, I'll take care of it for you, buddy. And then here's an exchange between Olmsted and a dispatcher, which is very Beer Baron-esque. The Federals will get you one of these days. Nope. Those sons of bitches are too slow to catch cold. So Olmsted reads all these pages, tries to hide the fact that he's getting very mad that he's being investigated. And as a former police officer, he said when he'd finished reading, he knew a thing or two about the rules of evidence. And because wiretapping was currently illegal in Washington, the pile of paper, while legitimate, would be thrown out of a courtroom immediately. So he says to Fryant, go to hell, because I'm not paying $10,000 for this. Olmsted's bravado did not prevent him from hiring a telephone repairman to search the Henry Building first thing in the morning. Together, they found and removed three temporary taps, two in the basement and one in the women's bathroom. So
two for the job and one for the perv. Yeah.
There's one wiretapper just like, I really think it should be in the woman's bathroom. Really.
We got video on this one as well.
Put on a nice low angle. Yeah. I think that's where we would get the best information.
So they've removed three taps. Olmsted's like, job well done. But then he's like, fuck, it's a bit sus, hey. He comes back the very next day. All three taps are back, including the one in the woman's bathroom. So Fryant, the wiretapper, and Whitney, the person he's working for, his wife Clara, who is a skilled stenographer, continued to monitor the wiretap from an office one floor below. At the day's end, Clara gathered up the handwritten notes and typed them with fastidious precision. So the pile of papers just begins to grow and grow. They've got tons of evidence on him. So Olmsted starts finally doing like a Stringer Bell, Avon Barksdale thing and becoming a little more obtuse. He didn't go full hog with like code and like avoiding phones because he still was like, at the end of the day, no matter what they get on us, the wiretaps are illegal. They will be thrown out in court. Right. So it's not like we need to be crazy about it. But
so
maybe
he's like, he's just like, I need a delivery of Frasier for my Nile tomorrow night.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. He's like, if you Roz what I Daphne. that's the best joke I've ever done. He started kind of using a public payphone instead of his home office phone to issue instructions. But for less sensitive issues, he still used his office line. And because he knew the wiretapper was wiretapping him, he decided to have a little fun with it and would occasionally feed false information about things that could get raids called on, and then police would show up and there would be no one there. Nice. He'd have a little chuckle to himself. But eventually, Canadian officials seize one of Olmsted's boats in October 1924. 3 months later, a federal grand jury returned an indictment against Olmsted and 90 co-defendants for conspiracy to violate the National Prohibition Act. The Whispering Wires case, as it came to be called, concluded with a guilty verdict, even though the wiretaps are illegal. And so he got a fine of $8,000 and a sentence of 4 years hard labor. So Olmsted serves his four-year sentence, yet in a way he managed to win his own case because Franklin Roosevelt gave him a presidential pardon, which restored all of his rights as a citizen, canceled the fine. Roosevelt was influenced in part by Olmsted's nascent transformation in prison, so he quit drinking, he converted to Christian Science and started teaching the Bible to prisoners who frequently asked if he was really that Roy Olmsted, the good bootlegger, the rum-running king of Puget Sound. His standard reply, no, not anymore, the old Olmsted is dead, amounted to fewer than 140 characters and were the words he wished the whole world to hear. So this whole wiretapping thing led to much grander implications down the line because they called it the Olmsted ruling because of the wiretapping stuff. And it led to like debates of like 20, 30, 40 years about a citizen's right to privacy. Mm. And it would influence wiretapping decisions in cases for years to come.
Interesting. Oh,
right.
Olmsted, okay. Hey?
So it's, tapping the mob in the 80s and all that stuff is all...
I think it's also a state-by-state thing. Right. Like, some states, it's legal to conduct wiretaps and some it's not. And then, again, it's hazy what you can and cannot do it for.
Right.
Right. Okay.
You can still put it in the women's bathroom, like, legally.
Sure.
Depends how badly you want to. Yeah. You really
how
want to.
How horny you are.
Exactly.
Speaking of beverages, I've got a cool little thing that popped up in the 90s. Just a random street, just on the street, a Coke machine popped up, plugged, and it was attached to, I think it was a locksmith's business, but they were like, this isn't ours. We don't know where this came from. And it was a standard, just like an old 90s looking Coke machine. And it was 75 cents for, Coke, Diet Coke, whatever the beverages were. But slowly over the years, the buttons changed from Coke, Diet Coke changed and it just said mystery. And then it eventually everything there just said mystery in this weird like yellow font. And stayed 75 cents. It's been there. I think it's gone now, but it was there for like decades. And basically you could go there. Nobody know who owned it. Nobody knows who restocked it. Like nobody has any idea where any of this stuff come from. And even though it was always 75 cents, when it changed to the mystery machine, you would hit the button for mystery and sometimes it would just give you like a normal Coke. But then sometimes it would give you these like really like obscure discontinued soft drinks that nobody knows where the fuck they came from. There's one called Sierra Mist and like it would give you like a Fresca or something. Mm-hmm. And so there's whole Reddit threads of people just being like, yeah, I remember this. I used to go chuck 75 cents in and you'd pull out a can that could like, these days if you put it on eBay, it would probably go for like thousands of dollars because it was intact. So some fucking eccentric billionaire with a hoard of discontinued soda cans was just filling this place up.
Mystery vendors, I'd be sucked right into that.
Yeah,
I'm like, even if I dime for a Coke, I'd press mystery. I'm like, come on, Coke. You know?
Where's Alex? He's playing the mystery machine. Like,
I got a feature. I got Coke. It's like a lucky dip. You know, lucky dip?
Yeah,
so like,
yeah,
and it's like $2. And then like you could also just buy whatever the best possible thing. But nah, the mystery.
The old mystery, yeah.
It sounds like a public piece of public art or performance.
I love
art
it. Like it's such a cool thing to pop up.
Maybe
I love
it's
like
Kurt Cobain behind it and he didn't really die.
Oh, interesting.
I'm sure that's possible.
Yeah. Is it still there?
Well, apparently not. So I think from memory, the area that it's in, they kind of, it got a bit gentrified and they built this like transit system or whatever. And so it was temporarily moved. And then I think I think it's gone now, which sucks because like,
that's what I
a little bit
the
of whimsy left in the world, you know.
About gentrification is losing access to the cool mystery soft drinks. That's the real suffering.
I love it. Yeah. All right, should we hit the last?
Yes. Okay, Laura. With your vast experience of Seattle and the university, if someone says, Laura, I'm coming to Seattle for a day and I need an itinerary, something to do morning, afternoon and night, what do you tell them to do? Where do you tell them to go?
Okay. Well, I think you got to go to Pike Place Markets, get some snacks, get some.
What's Pike Place Markets?
Oh, that's the big markets in the city. It's like, it's not like Paddy's.
It's a huge farmer's market.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Like massive, like fresh fruit, fresh fish.
But knickknacks and homeware. Crap,
not so much. Mostly food.
And
yeah.
It's got like a lot of restaurants on it. Cool. And like food vendors. Yep. It's awesome.
Yeah, lots of fresh seafood and seafood places.
Beautiful.
Bars, cafes. Have a look around there. Have a coffee. Go to the first Starbucks. Get a coffee.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Is there anything like special, obviously it's the first one, but is it like look weird? Is it where
it just looks like a Starbucks?
Fair enough. Okay.
Yeah, but you know, then you can say you did. Just be like, I've been to the OG, baby.
Yeah,
been where it all started. Yeah, then maybe go for like a hike or something. Like, there's lots of beautiful mountains around Seattle, Mount Rainier. I went on a day trip up to like Oregon and all some of the places they film parts of the Twilight movies. Like the
did you go specifically because of that or?
Yes. Not me personally, but like a bunch of international students.
I was dragged along.
They all wanted to go, and so we went on this trip. But like, yeah, beautiful beaches. Like the scenes where there's like all those driftwood washed up on the beach, and it's all very rugged and rainy and cliffy. And yeah, go for a hike or something like that.
What about the Space Needle? Is that worth checking out?
Yeah,
just a fun.
It's kind of like Center Point Tower, and it's like revolving restaurant. It's like,
yeah,
it's a big tall thing. I don't know. Yeah, nothing to
you
do.
Got a
there.
Big tall thing right here.
We do. Yeah. What more do you need?
Like eight on my head while I spin around.
Exactly.
Wouldn't mind staring at him all day, taking a photo next to him. What about nighttime?
I'd probably go see a band or like go see a movie or something. I think there was a little neighborhood that it wasn't Fremont, but it was like one of the other neighborhoods where there's like lots of live music. And I think we went to see a horror film, like a schlock horror film, like old cinemas. And there's heaps of cool stuff to do at night.
I like it.
Crazy music history we didn't get into.
Yeah.
Nirvana, Pearl Jam,
Soundgarden.
Did you guys get into grunge when it
loved,
was like around?
Loved
yeah,
it.
Yeah, like not. Mm. I feel like it was already when I musically became
You have an
conscious.
Older sibling?
Yeah, my sister loved. My sister
I feel like
loved
I missed it
Nirvana
because I didn't have a cool older sibling. Well, I would have been 7 when it like broke and it completely passed me by.
Yeah, it's like, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
exactly.
I had Blaine's older brother who was into Nirvana and shit, so that trickled down through there.
Yeah.
Fuck, I still love Nirvana. They're so good.
R.I.P. I mean, unless Kurt's hiding in the mystery soft drink machine, in which case, go off.
Somehow more tragic than ever. He's just refilling an old vending machine.
Beautiful.
All right. Oh, and your last question. Last question.
Go.
Laura, with all the riches you make from comedy, all the Adelaide runs you can muster, millions of dollars are at stake. Would you consider settling down in Seattle?
I don't think I would. I'd go there for a holiday. I'd love to go back to the US for a holiday. And I'd love to travel all up and down the West Coast. Like, I never went to, like, California. I only went up to Oregon. And, I'd love to go to San Francisco. And, I'd love to go back. But I don't think I would live there. It's just
too rainy.
It's rainy. And it's just, yeah, they're fucking, they're coming. it's hard, right? Like, it's, they got no healthcare, they got guns. It's a bit scary. It's nice here.
As crazy as the rainy thing, because I've never been there, but, you know, everyone says it's rainy, but I read it gets, like, half as much rain as London. It's just rainy compared to elsewhere in the US.
Yeah.
But it's, like, you know, still, it's probably not much more rainy than Sydney or something that. It's just... California is so dry, I think, that it's in comparison there.
But it'd be like London, like if it was 16 degrees, like Celsius, everyone would get their tops off and lie on the the slightest hint of the sun, everyone's like, whoa, let's go.
Let's get our tops
off. Yeah.
All right.
Last question. Do you have anything you'd like to plug? I believe you do.
Oh, yes. Me and Alex are both going to do shows at the Melbourne International Comedy Festival in March and April, and we actually have a deal.
We got a deal.
Oh, baby. Yeah.
Two for the Art price of, the of deal. Guess what? How, what's the price? Guess
four.
Two for the price. Two for the price of four. Yeah, yes. It's a jokey bad publicity stunt. No, me, Laura, and Steph Broadbridge as well. We're all doing shows, and there's a code if you use that when you buy tickets.
What's the code?
Explain it. SYD 2-for-1.
SYD 2-for-1. One.
And if you buy two of our shows, it's only one.
So it's for three shows, but encouraging you to choose your two favourites of the three.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah. What a rankings to be made.
Yeah, I mean, look.
Or you could do 3-for-2. It's like the same thing, right? Yeah. You know what I mean? You can get
all
three. But also, they're on a different time. So I think, Steph's, what's your dates? Go look.
My dates are from the 26th of March to the 7th of April at the venue's called Storyville. It's in the city. I'm on at 6:45 on weekends.
Yeah, so I'm on the second half. I'm from the 5th to the 20th. So if you're there, if you're around in the first half, go see Laura and Steph, because I think Steph's in the first half. But there's a bit of an overlap between us two. So just buy, support Laura. This is, you know, this is your show. This is your rep. I'm going to plug on other ones. But yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
And if you come on the weekend of the 14th of April,
I'll be
in the audience cheering at you guys on.
Yay. Drewy's coming down.
It's going to be a lot of fun. Outside the studio being like, hello.
I'm going to do some mic tests. Yeah.
Surprise live pod.
I'll do a writing solo where I do all three characters.
Are you going to jump?
I'm real short. Yeah,
gonna move around the
between the seats. Yeah, perfect.
All right,
awesome stuff.
What an episode.
Thanks once so again, like, subscribe.
Oh yeah,
yeah, Patreon.
Oh yeah, yeah. We have a Patreon. You can get it at patreon.com/communitynoticeboard or the link in our Instagram bio. It's $5 a month, and it gets you 2 bonus episodes a month, including coming up.
It's going to be
later than we think now because we had a little scheduling snafu.
It's going to happen.
But the Oyster Challenge with Jack Wright is coming.
We're going to do a proper ep on like a main feed ep on competitive eating with Jack. And then we're going to film a Patreon after that where Jack has to eat 100 oysters
as fast as he can.
And he thinks he can do it in 10 minutes.
I was in Adelaide with Jack and he would not stop talking about how you guys aren't going to buy enough oysters and the challenge isn't going to work because he's going to eat too many oysters and you're not going to be able to keep up with how many oysters he's going to eat.
My Lord.
And I was are going to
Jack
go to
going
hospital.
Jack is going to be very sick.
Yeah. It's going to be so funny. So we haven't figured out I think we're going to try to make him 1 a minute because I think the cadence of it needs important.
It's oyster power hour. And one oyster, 1 minute.
And then that'll be on the Patreon.
And I want like at least a dozen for myself. We're going to buy like 150 oysters.
Yeah, it's going to be silly. But we're so excited. And Jack's, his only criticism is he doesn't think we're ready for his abilities. So funny.
He calls us idiots.
Yeah. So subscribe to get ahead of the game on that one because it's going to be a lot of fun.
And we've got lots of good apps on there already.
Yeah.
Sure.
All right. We'll see you next week, everybody.
Thanks.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.